Now these lipid contain capsulated mRNA pieces, I guess, going to hijack a couple of your cells near the injection site, and then your cells start producing the spike proteins, which then will trigger the antibody response. So my question is, are those just the cells in that particular area? And I guess it gets into the cytoplasm of the cell. It has nothing to do with the nucleus at this point. And what happens to those cells? Then they die? They lose their normal functionality? And is it just when you run out of these pieces of mRNA, that's how many cells will be infected with it? I'm saying infected, let's say injected with it. You know, where does it get limited? And, you know, what damage might it be doing in that area, if any?
Well, theoretically, not a great deal of damage. That's the whole idea of these studies, to see both efficacy and safety. What happens, as you mentioned, is that it's absorbed in sundry cells in the area that the subcutaneous injection is performed. It really shouldn't go into the nucleus. It won't, but it's because it wouldn't be useful. It goes into the cytoplasm, eventually gets near the areas where proteins are manufactured, gets misrecognized as another chain of RNA that'll just code for cell proteins, but instead of cell proteins, it codes for the spike. Eventually, there's a buildup of the spike. Whether there's a mechanism for the cell to self-destruct because it's making foreign protein, or it just clogs up the system, there's something that's going to require the cell to just kind of become disrupted and leak out the proteins, and those proteins are going to be kind of taken up by lymphatics and blood vessels and go through the lymphatic, white blood cells will recognize it as a foreign protein and manufacture antibodies and other immune responses from it.
All righty, and if the proteins leaving the cell doesn't damage it, I guess theoretically the nucleus will be providing the normal mRNA of the cell anyway, and it may just continue doing what it did before the vaccine. I don't know. But I guess there's so few that it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't really read about the nitty-gritty details. As long as it's a temporary measure, because as we mentioned before, messenger RNA has a finite life expectancy, so eventually it's going to be acted on by local enzymes and broken down into precursors so that it would seemingly go back to the nucleus and produce another template of proteins. And then if the cell isn't destroyed, it just goes back to what it was doing before it was invaded by foreign messenger RNA.
Yeah, very interesting. Very cool. So we're in effect vaccine producers. That's pretty cool. That's thinking outside the box. All right. Thank you. NY2H.
You're welcome. I mean, this messenger RNA technology is incredibly innovative, but it was problematic in that it was very innovative. There has not been a single vaccine that was commercially manufactured using this method. These are the first, so we got lucky, apparently. I hope we continue to be lucky.
Luck is part of it, but imagine if we were compliant. Imagine if people would just do what they're supposed to be doing. That would help, too. All right. Thanks. NY2H, clear.
Yes, indeed. I really wish people were somewhat more rational than they can sometimes be. Although, you know, history does repeat itself. There's a lot of very good books written about the great influenza Spanish pandemic. of 1918, 1920. And human beings did the same stupid mistakes then that they do now. So we haven't changed much. You know, evolution is a very, very, very slow process.
WS2N, one more question, Roy.
Yes, Paul.
Okay, you inject this mRNA in, and apparently it's going to create its own vaccine. And it'll work, but for how long? I mean, is it going to last a year, 2 years, for life? You know, and then let's say it lasts a year. Does it leave the body or stop working and, like you said, have all the cells go back to the way it was originally? And if that's true, I'm assuming that if you went to a foreign country and that country didn't have the injections yet, you could still catch the virus, you know, even, 2 years down the road, if this thing apparently wears, you know, after injecting it, let's say it only lasts a year. So I would imagine you'd have to get re-injected if you're going to go to a country where they didn't vaccinate people. Back to you, Roy.
Well, the simple answer that doesn't help anyone is we don't know. If you really definitively want to know how long a vaccination protects someone, you vaccinate them and then you let them out into the real world, and 5 or 10 years later you collate all the information and you figure out, did they get infected? How long after the vaccine did they get infected? And you plot the distribution and come to some conclusion. If you're going to come up with a solution to this within about 6 months, you don't have years to study it, so you don't really know. There was a lot of concern in that early studies demonstrated that antibody formation occurs after an infection, but slowly diminishes. And after about 2 months, the amount of antibodies become much, much lower. And there were also a few cases of people who got infections a second time by a different variation of the same strain. Later studies have suggested that other forms of immunity, not totally antibody-based, also are involved in protecting us. So there's a little bit more optimism that the vaccines do last longer than 2 months. How much longer? No one knows. Some vaccinations are once in a lifetime. Other vaccinations are once in 10 years. You don't know until you try it and you see what you get. It's also unfortunately possible viruses do undergo genetic drift. It is within the realm of possibilities that this coronavirus can genetically drift to the point where it is not recognized by our vaccine. That hasn't been the case yet, and hopefully it won't. But that's another big question mark. You know, there are some things that you take once and you're vaccinated against it, as everyone who hopefully took their influenza vaccine this year. It's an annual affair. So we won't know until we know.
KG2RY.
Yes, David.
Roy, the president went into Walter Reed Hospital. He received treatment. From what we could tell, it was effective treatment, and maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Okay. We don't know a great deal, unfortunately, because there's not a great deal of transparency, and there's a lot of conflicting stories. It sort of sounded like he might have had early viral pneumonitis, but he might not have. He had a cocktail of a bunch of different things. Memory serves me, he had a very potent steroid, which is an anti-inflammatory. He had remdesivir, which is an antiviral which has been approved for emergency use, but the World Health Organization studies seem to demonstrate that it's not particularly effective on this virus. And he also received a antibody cocktail, concentrations of other people who had the infection and survived it, and they purified the antibodies. So those were the three. Also, I think he had something like magnesium shots, but those are the principal three drugs. Now, you can't definitively say that that cured him, because even in his age and sex and underlying health situation, at worst, he would have a 1 out of 10 chance of getting really sick. So it could have been just been the luck of the draw, or it could have been the antibiotic cocktail. We'll never quite know for sure. I mean, eventually we'll probably be able to access his medical records, you know, decades from now. But, you know, it's possible that the antiviral, that the antibody cocktail was helpful. The steroids made him feel a little bit better. I don't know if it's, it's not particularly curative. It's more to lessen that cascade failure that was giving people the respiratory distress and requiring their intubation.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
All righty. So when you said the cocktail, it sounded like you were talking about convalescent serum, but I think he had monoclonal antibodies. He had a two of them, I guess, in one serving of monoclonal antibodies, which I guess makes sense, because it sounds to me that the strategy was, throw everything at him. And problem is, if you throw the steroid at him, you're going to reduce his immune response, but that didn't matter because we weren't counting on his immune response. We were giving him already manufactured antibodies. And I think the monoclonal antibodies is what really helped him.
Well, it's possible. This is all very preliminary, sketchy information. There have been two manufacturers with monoclonal antibodies. I think the other one was not found to be as useful as this particular manufacturer. So, you know, a lot of these things are bleeding edge, and no one quite knows. Basically the concept was throw everything against the wall and see if anything sticks.
Yeah, and again, typically they would hold off on the steroids until you were in some kind of distress, because that'll be an immune suppressant. So timing is everything. But, I guess the monoclonal antibodies are produced via some live cell tissue, and that's, you know, and I guess that's where people were saying maybe it was embryonic tissue or what have you, but I guess they produce them in some cell culture, and then that's how they're manufactured.
KAC2PL.
Yes, Jeff recognized. One sec. The thing is, you know, they're not exactly embryo cells. They're derived from embryo cells. The cell line, cell lines usually come from embryos. They come from malignant cells. They come from all kinds of interesting places. Yes, Jeff.
Now, you covered it. The cell lines are used for just about everything in biological research. So anyone who's trying to politicize that should probably stop right there.
Let me see if I have it.
It didn't seem like he was in terrible distress. And there were people in his circle, members of his family and other government figures, that also got the COVID-19 virus. And all of them, you know, we didn't hear any news about them.
Why don't we have a medical net on this repeater? We never could quite get it going. But now that we have you at the helm, it's good. And so, good info. NY2H.
Well, thank you, Lou. And getting back to what David said, it's the law of averages. I mean, that's the kind of slippery slope problem I have with some people. Yeah, it's not a sure death. Congratulations to everyone. But still, even if just 1% of people die, that's a lot of people. The idea of just opening everything up and hoping for herd immunity would probably lead to an extra million or 2 million people dying who don't necessarily have to die. Thankfully, with the exception of that guy who ran for president, Kane, he died of COVID infection. But everyone else in the administration, fortunately, got better, and I wish them all well. I wish everyone well. And as a comment to Jeff, people are going to use whatever mud they have in their hands. And so I saw that coming from a mile away. I don't think anyone really bothered to do anything with it. It just hung there, just along with all the other nonsense that we've had to listen to from everyone.
Yeah, but you know, I was saying the reason why I mentioned all these other people, they were probably taking the same treatment as the president, or at least I would think that they were. And so, you know, if this is effective, and this is proven effective and tested, you know, then it has some value, I think.
Well, you're judging something that I have no way of knowing. It's not as though it was reported. They felt the need to explain what was going on with the President of the United States. But as for, and at last count, I think there's been at least 100 different people at the executive branch in the White House who have come down with the virus. I haven't heard a single report of how they were treated. Just because he had that type of a treatment doesn't necessarily mean that everyone had that type of treatment.
QSL, QSL. But I still think that, you know, whatever we do, we can learn from it and gain knowledge from it. You know, that, you know, I have personal feelings about, you know, how the president got through it so quickly and so easily.
Well, steroids can have an amazing superficial effect on people. And if you caught the video of him when he was walking up those stairs, he was kind of huffing and puffing. So, and also if you look closely at the records, I think he used to spend at the campaign functions an hour and a half. At first it was a lot shorter than that. So there was probably some degree of kind of pulling back on a lot of things. He got away rather clear, and again, all the other people apparently did, with the exception of Herb Kane, who passed away, got away with it. But that's the nature of something that has somewhere around the 1% mortality rate. Most people survive it. There might be complications down the road for some people. Again, that's another thing that only history will prove or disprove, but we'll see. Any other questions, comments, or what have you on this particular subject?
One person dead is too many people. Thank you, Roy.
I agree with you completely, David. I took an oath. Do no harm. 1% is 1% too much.
And Y 2H.
Yes, Lou.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we have a quarter of a million already. Yeah, so I'm doing on a percentage basis. I mean, you just watch the news and watch what's going on in these hospitals. It's not a joke. But anyway, the only other question I had was in terms of long term. You know, they're talking about the long haulers and they're suspecting possible small blood clots, different organs that may be creating issues. And I'm wondering if the spike protein that we're going to produce from the vaccine can pass the brain-blood barrier And if, you know, the brain sometimes with Alzheimer's and stuff, we have other proteins, the amyloid and the tau and all that, you know, just looking very, very long range if there's any potential, or if they even thought about that, of some of the stuff accumulating in the brain, you know, the antigen itself.
I don't know for a fact. I would assume it's not terribly likely. The spike proteins are very active in epithelial cells, and that's why it massively collects in the upper and lower respiratory tract and the GI tract and the blood vessels. And it's through that mechanism that clotting factors are screwed up and microemboli form, and you develop clots in different places, and you can have neurological damage due to neurological clots and kidney problems and all kinds of things. So unless there's something completely hidden, I think it's more of a vascular complication neurologically than it is a inclusion of the spike protein. I think for the most part, the spike proteins are just the narrow end of the spear, getting the virus into the system, and then it wreaks havoc. You know, with the exception of screwing up your angiotensin converting enzyme, you know, system, I think that's the only problem that the protein itself has.
Yeah, initially I went off my ACE2 inhibitor for hypertension, but then had a discussion with the doctor and I went back on about a month ago, and I just read yesterday that it's actually helping, not hurting, so it's counterintuitive. They did a retrospective study and found that some people have actually benefited, you know, people that were on it had better outcomes, so. Yeah, very, very, very cool. I watched this doctor on YouTube, Dr. Mo Bean, and he puts out a video every day, and he gets down into the mud with all his, with all the mechanisms. That's really, I'm learning a lot. Anyway, interesting. Back tonight, I guess we have Wesley and Paul to go. So I will bow out. Take care. See you later. NY2H.
Okay. Take care, Lou. Yeah, you don't need me to say that medicine is fascinating. I picked that as a career. And complicated beyond belief. And again, if anyone has nothing better to do and doesn't get headaches, look up a cell biochemistry. There's lots of very interesting charts that diagram something like 1/10,000th of a percent of the biochemical pathways that go on in the average human cell every day, with us not aware of it. And it kind of strikes me still as amazing. You know, I find RF amazing and magical. I find the biochemistry equally amazing and unbelievable. Anyway, on to the next. So, Wesley, you wanted to bring up a question?
Yes, I have a subject to discuss. I have a few questions. And also to you. Thank you very much for your time. Okay. Number of universities were working on the Big Bang theory and evolution of universe from its earliest moment. And the theory of Big Bang was established, and we went to a few possible explanations of what was before that. So it is possible, one of the theories is that it is possible that before the Big Bang, the universe was an infinite stretch of ultra-hot dense material, persisting in steady state until, for some reason, the Big Bang occurred. That's one of the ways of explaining it. We have some traditional models of universe. We have initial singularity of the Big Bang. And then we might say, how about if there was no mass? Let me drop. And we can take as an example, the electron beam could act as a wave or like a particle. So in other words, Broglie found, was speculated that wave and a particle create some sort of duality, and it acts either like a wave or like a particle. But we have a photon that doesn't have that doesn't have mass, but it has energy. So we may say that electron could act as a wave, having a property of photons, or as a particle, having mass. And by that, we could have some analogy to that. What about if we say what was before? Now I have two choices. One of them is ask you the questions, or the other way is just to explain my point. Which one would you like?
I guess it would be best if you asked the question.
How about if we assume that it was energy, dense energy, that was condensed? But before that energy was condensed, that energy was not condensed. And then if it was not condensed, it was only energy, and based on Broglie, duality is a property not only of light, photons, but also of matter as well. So we might say, I may ask you a question. What that energy came from? And to exist.
Okay, well, that's the billion-dollar question, because no one really knows. There are some physicists who probably would have made terrible accountants who will tell you that the net energy of the universe is zero. They take that from stating that that gravitational potential energy is actually negative energy, and if you add up all the negative potential gravitational energy, it's the same as the other energy in this universe, and so the net total energy in this universe is zero. I don't particularly agree with that. I think it's playing a numbers game. Then there's another problem. We've talked about it before. There's a whole bunch of problems. One is that mass is energy. Energy is mass. The mass is simply a form of concentrated energy. Photons are energy. They have momentum. Momentum, like anything that has mass, they are said to have a inertial equivalent mass. All of their equivalent mass is based upon their energy content. That's why if you stop a photon, the rest mass of a photon is zero, and when you stop a photon, it ceases to exist. So that's one part. Also, there's no real thing as conservation of mass energy. We've talked about that. It occurs in small areas, like on Earth. For all intents and purposes, mass energy is conserved. But in the universe that's expanding, since space changes volume, there's no conservation of energy. So energy increases over time. As the universe is set to expand, the vacuum energy increases because the vacuum energy is a constant, and as you increase the volume of vacuum, you increase the vacuum energy.
Okay. How would you describe Mobius. And I can give you the quite difficult to understand definition, but I would like you to use it in a form of simple words. So Mobius is a surface with only one side, when embedded in three-dimensional Euclidean space and only one boundary curve. How would you use the much simpler wording to describe it?
I'm not exactly sure what you're talking about there. Are you talking about space-time topology? Are you talking about Riemann space? I'm not quite sure what it is you're getting at.
Let's start from a simple strip. Strip of paper that is glued together and creates Mobius. No end, no beginning. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I'm familiar with Mobius strips. I've made them as a child. They're kind of fascinating. You're talking about topology. Matter of fact, when I was doing the 3D printing, I had a Klein bottle, which is sort of a three-dimensional Mobius strip.
So we have one piece of puzzle, which is Mobius. Another piece of puzzle is seesaw, when two children pass up and down. Do I say it properly, seesaw?
I don't understand the allusion to a seesaw.
But do I pronounce properly seesaw?
Yes, it's usually a plane of wood that has two weights on either side and children kicking up and down.
And the third element of the puzzle is battery. Battery, when it's charged, has plus and minus. This is not the smartest example, but let's take it as a primitive example. But when the battery is dead, there is no plus and minus, it's equilibrium, it's balance. So, how do we say this? If I ask you a question, what energy comes from, what would be your answer?
Energy is kind of inherent in the system. You can move it around, you can change it. You can't make it out of nothing, and you can't make it go away.
But energy existed before the Big Bang, or didn't exist?
Well, it sort of depends on the theory that you want to promote. There are a lot of people who say that the Big Bang started from what they call a quantum instability in space-time that led to a cascade of the Big Bang. That before that time, there was nothing before, because the Big Bang itself defines the onset of time. So something happening a fraction of a second before time began is a meaningless concept. There are other people who believe that there is a multiverse with a higher dimension, and that our universe is simply one of many, many, many that are embedded within the fabric of something like an 11-dimension space-time.
But I believe you didn't answer the question, or I didn't catch it. Did energy exist before it became bank? Not asking about anything else, just about the energy.
It may have, but it's not necessary. Again, there is no real conservation of mass energy. As the universe got bigger, it created more energy, unfortunately, to the confusion of all physicists and even non-physicists like myself. So you can model a Big Bang in which there was no energy before it.
I had a discussion with Dr. Hans, my friend, And we spent a few hours talking about that, and we came to a very much uncommon conclusion, or conclusion that wasn't yet available for me to be found. Let me go. Nature likes balance, or let's call it equilibrium. If there is a seesaw and the seesaw is left in one position, let's say there is no force acting on that seesaw, it's going to stay there for billions of years. Nothing is going to happen. If we have a Mobius, and there is something on the Mobius that's supposed to move in that Mobius, but there is no force, and force has a vector, so there is no force and there is no vector because there is no force. So if there is no force, force didn't have any vector, then that Mobius is going to be by itself, theoretical, physical, whatever, it's going to be there. How about if the beginning of everything was a balance? So let's say there is a balance. Nothing else, just a balance. In empty space, there is nothing, no energy yet. At some point, for some reason, at one point of the universe, there is some form of this balance. And we don't have a mass yet. The form of that this balance has one particular property, has a vector. It's like battery, when you charge it just a little bit, it's going to have a plus and a minus. It's like when you touch the seesaw, it's going to move at a certain vector, it's in a certain direction. Let me drop. And then we're coming to electrons. If we have a particle duality, and mass could act as energy, and energy could act as a mass, then we have a conversion from energy to mass and mass to energy. Now, for some reason, we have a disbalance in this one point of the universe. And then we're creating we have a vector. And that vector is creating energy disbalance. So that energy disbalance now has less of something and more of something. An energy unit is a photon, and photon can act as a particle, or it can act as an energy. Now, because there is that this balance had a force, and probably that we may say it was electrostatic force, that was collecting more and more of whatever was around, or whatever the force was collecting more of, and then we have a creation of a photon. And the photon is energy. We have a beginning of energy. Let me jump. Now, since we have a beginning of energy, we have accumulation of energy at a certain point, like in a battery, like in, because we have a vector. So energy, photon has a vector. So photon is actually going at a certain vector. Now, accumulation creates another forces. Now we have, since we have more of the disbalance, we have more energy in the form of photons going to a certain point. Till we have the more we have of that disbalance, we create more of disbalance and more accumulation at a certain point. Now we have a humongous amount of energy that could act as a mass or convert to the mass. And now we have a Big Bang. In the time of the Big Bang, that energy spreads and starts to spit from itself for the very long period of time, or maybe for the minimum unit of time, spit that energy in form of the mass. And now we have a creation of gravitation. And now force of gravitation is taking more and more of the mass. Now we have a creation of the solar bodies. And now we have a solar system and we have a planet Earth.
Wesley?
Go ahead.
Yeah, you're kind of smearing out the Big Bang to billions of years. There was a long history of a lot of other things long before hydrogen could coalesce and compress and become fissionable and produce stars. There were a long time between the Big Bang, supposedly, and the first star. And also, you're kind of leaving quantum mechanics out of the whole equation. And the big thing about quantum mechanics is that there's no real such thing as steady state. There is a perpetual kind of ebb and flow and fluctuation. That's why empty space isn't completely energy free. It's the very basis of quantum mechanics that there is such a thing as the vacuum energy.
I don't believe I'm leaving quantum mechanics behind. I was waiting for that correction from you, and thank you very much for that. I was expecting you to correct me. The thing is that if we include this balance as the beginning of everything, then we have a perfect answer what energy came from. And to exchange.
Well, you know, I mean, it begs all kinds of questions. You're saying that it started with a photon, and somehow the photon destabilized the balance, and the only direction was more photons. The given theory is a quantum instability that produced something of a very high energetic level. The point being that the energy levels were supposedly so high, you're talking about infinities, that physics, the laws of physics break down, that all the four major forms of force were basically identical at those energy levels. It's only at lower energy levels do photons and W and Z bosons and gravitons and quarks become drop out of some kind of symmetry, higher symmetry, where all those forms of force are different aspects of the same thing.
No, we were assuming with Dr. Hans that there is a perfect balance. There is a perfect balance of nothing. So it's a perfect balance, it's equilibrium. And then, when you disturb the equilibrium, you're creating energy. And that energy can convert itself to mass. And that is absolutely along with quantum mechanics. Do you agree with that?
Theoretically, yes. Practically, again, the theory would say that you have to kind of define your terms a little bit. It's not as though after the Big Bang there was hydrogen and helium and such. After the Big Bang there was a lot of energy and not very big, much volume. And as it expanded, it cooled down. As it cooled down, you were left with photons converting into electrons and quarks, and electrons and quarks converting into photons, and the other force carriers interacting with photons, and everything was interacting and going in and out of existence. And it's only after it cooled down and stabilized that the photons couldn't really change into W bosons or gravitons or gluons. And then you were left with quarks and electrons, and then the quarks finally dropped in energy level so that the quarks could bind and form neutrons and protons, and then finally, a long time later, electrons could no longer be ionized, and they'd be captured by the protons, and you'd have the first hydrogen. So it's a much more complicated, more long-winded type of thing. This didn't happen in a snap of a finger. It happened in millions of years.
I absolutely agree with you, but everything what I say is very much in line with what you're saying. What I'm trying to say is that if you have point in Mobius, but there is an equilibrium, and let's say Mobius doesn't have a physical dimension, it's a Mobius, it's a closed loop with no end and no beginning. The old theories trying to say, or at least suggest, that we could have a shrinking as the expanding process might much before the Big Bang, and it was repeating itself and whatsoever. But let's say there was a first Big Bang. It was a first something that was based on the energy, condensed energy. But condensed energy doesn't not having a mass yet. So the old nuclear process or whatever processes happened before that Big Bang will happen based on the energy. But if there is equilibrium, there is no energy. So this balance, presence of certain amount of this balance at the certain point of universe made everything happen. And that's what you said is exactly with line, in line with that what Dr. Hans and I are telling now.
Well, like I said before, the standard theory, and there are a lot of variations, and most of the theories don't involve themselves much in what happened before, because there's pretty much no way of proving what came before, because a lot of the theories premise that time itself didn't start until the Big Bang. So I think you have an extra layer of complications and such. They make it relatively simpler that there is just a point of there's a point singularity that's unstable because quantum mechanics has a probabilistic fluctuation, and that means that there's always the chance of it destabilizing.
But you're trying to come back to the space-time of the universe, to the initial singularity, and we may also include their traditional models of the universe that were rejected because of physics accepting the new model. And I don't believe there is a complication, because if student at the last class of high school is going to ask you what energy came from, you are trying to look for the simplest way to explain that to that student. So if I was the student and I was asking you the simplest way to explain what energy came from, would that be the word disbalance? Entry.
Again, my answer would be no. The problem is that really when you get to the nitty-gritty, there are a whole bunch of things that we use every day that if you scrape the surface, we really don't have an accurate, meaningful description. I give you as another example other than energy, time. What is time? You could ask five physicists and get 17 different answers. You could say that time is a measurement of causality, but then you got to explain what causality is, and then you have to explain what entropy is, and then you have to explain a whole bunch of other terms. So, as I mentioned before, energy is not conserved, and mass and energy is equivalent, so that the same space-time distortions that occur from the planet Earth will occur if you have a very intense light source. It's possible to make a black hole that's purely made out of light. It still would have a black hole. It still will have a curvature of space-time. They're just two versions of the same exact thing. Mass is energy. Energy is mass. It's not that they're equivalent. It's that they're just two aspects of the same exact thing. It's sort of the same thing as the concept of wave-particle duality. It isn't that objects are sometimes waves and sometimes particles. It's that things are something that we don't quite get our heads wrapped around, that sometimes acts as a wave, sometimes acts as a particle, but ultimately are really neither of them, unfortunately.
You touch time. Time is defined, indefined, continuous progress of existence and events that occur irreversibly as a succession from the past to the present and from the present to the future. If we take that explanation, we don't need to deal with anything else. Do you agree with that, at least?
No. What you're defining is the arrow of time, the directionality of time. You're not really getting into the nitty-gritty of what time itself is. Time has an apparent direction because of the law of entropy. Since entropy is said to always increase over time, then the time can't go back and forth because you have to have causality. You have to have cause and effect. So if you have cause and then effect, you can't have a system where you have an effect and then you have a cause. So it's not time that you're defining in that phrase. It's simply the arrow of time, which is just the vector, not what the vector is about.
Perfect, I agree. And now we're coming back to what I said. And there was a balance. There was nothing. There was no energy because there was a balance, equilibrium. Once this balance occurs, we have a vector. We have a closed loop, we have a closed system. And then we have a disbalance in the closed system. We have a point on Mobius. And all of a sudden, that point on Mobius has a vector. And because of this balance, that point on Mobius is moving, but it's moving nowhere from the beginning to the end, but there is no end and there is no beginning, so it's constantly moving. So we may say that at the beginning of the time was no energy. I mean, yeah, I agree what you say, but let's assume that there was no energy, was just the balance, was just the equilibrium. And now, because of this balance, we have a vector. And now, we have a repeated cycle of the same all over again. The only one change is that it would never be like it was before. It would never be equilibrium. Do you agree with that?
Well, presently, no, it's not going to return to the way it is. One of the things, again, is the arrow of time. There was a thought back in the good old days, and I really like the Big Bang, Big Crush theory, that as time went on, gravity would cause the slowing down of the repulsion from the Big Bang. It would collapse into a black hole. Dick, K2RIW, may rest in peace, used to believe that the universe will return to a black hole. And then he thought that the black hole would be unstable, explode, and you would get another Big Bang. So it would be an endless stream of Big Bangs. Some people theorize that history would just repeat itself. Others that things would be different with each level. And then, unfortunately, someone figured out that the speed of the universe flying apart is speeding up, not slowing down, which put the kibosh on that theory.
I do thank you very much. It was time well spent. I appreciate your opinion in this area. I assume also that you never met a similar form of thinking, that the beginning of everything was balanced. And that there was equilibrium, the first equilibrium that will never happen again. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time. And to you.
You're welcome, Wesley. And by the way, I mean, if you want a symbol for something that never has an ending, you could just take the circumference of a circle.
Could you explain to me what is the difference between Möbius and circle?
Well, they're different geometries, but they have the same quality that you keep on imbuing on a Möbius strip. With the circumference of a circle, there is no beginning, there is no end. It goes round and round and round and round.
The difference between a circle and a Möbius is area. Entropy shift.
Okay, well, I mean, one is a two-dimensional object, one is a three-dimensional object. One has a surface and the other just has a line. But, you know, if you were just going for the object that has no origin and no termination point, a simpler demonstration would be a circle. But you're free to use a Möbius. I don't know if you ever saw my Klein bottle. That's a fascinating construct.
Thank you for that. Dr. Roy, in order for anything to happen, that must be a dimension four. And when we look at line is just space between two points. It's not the space. Line is just me looking from one point to another at a certain distance. In order for anything to happen in the very, very past, there has to be an area. So that has to be a Möbius. So we could now use an analogy, let me just. For repeatedness of the process, with some changes, which would never be equilibrium like it was before, we have to use a Möbius. And we put the vector on Möbius, not vector on circle. Because there is no area on it. Entry exit.
Wouldn't you rather have something that has a volume?
Well, Möbius can be tri-dimensional, but can be two-dimensional. But if we look at the structure of the Möbius, it appears for us as tri-dimensional, so is space. Entry exit.
Yeah, but the characteristics are surface characteristics. It has one surface. And surfaces are two-dimensional things as opposed to three-dimensional things. The entire construction is three-dimensional, but the strip itself is two-dimensional.
I have a problem with that. Möbius has tri-dimensional appearance in space. It cannot be flat and put on a plane. Möbius, although it has only one surface, and if we look at the surface in given point from one edge of the Möbius to the other edge of the Möbius, we're dealing with lines. But collection of the lines gives you tri-dimensional area of the Möbius. So it is a beginning of the time explanation with Möbius having, with something on a Möbius having a vector in tri-dimensional space. And to exit.
Well, once again, you can actually draw a vector as a tangent to a circle. And as I said before, although a Möbius in real life is a three-dimensional object, the surface of the strip is a two-dimensional thing, not a three-dimensional thing. And you can create topological three-dimensional versions of a Möbius strip. But I'm just quibbling here.
And my position in this is that there is no two-dimensional Möbius in Euclidean space. It doesn't exist. Tri-dimensional Euclidean space is a space for Mobius. Is any other space good for Mobius? That would be a question.
I then it would be something other than a Mobius strip. It was in a higher dimension.
Yeah, that was more even interesting talking about Mobius with